This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
And joining us, so this is a freewheeling discussion. We haven't really a theme except this title, Ubu meets Gertrude, by which we wanted to go back to that term that maybe we could re-explore with you if you want, since we have one of the leading specialists of pataphysics in this room, Christian, here. But it's also connected with the work we have done here with William Anastasi, who has been instrumental in, I think, connecting textual and visual issues, and it's also something I'd like to explore with you, since after all we are not at the MLA, but we are in a gallery, and there is a different space, and a different space for a different kind of visual aids, and it's perhaps with these two questions I'd like to start. First, that idea, at least if for those of you who may not be familiar with the work of William Anastasi, that there would be a tradition, that would be a pataphysical tradition, that goes back to Jarry, the inventor of pataphysics, through Stein and the American avant-garde in the 1920s or so, to a number of artists associated with Fluxus and a certain avant-garde. So do you buy this idea, or would you replace it with another kind of tradition, or would you not see any need for the invention of such a tradition? And then the second question I'd like perhaps to start with, but we can go in any other topic you want to engage with, is the link between the visual, the auditory, the oral, and the textual, simply, which is often for us condensed in the space of the book, but may not be limited by the book. And I think stickers, as part of a sort of expansion, as Mallarmé said, the expansion of the letter, is also a way of going beyond the space of the page, the book, and here we have the gallery and perhaps the city and posters that can be glued on cars and whatever.
Okay. Well, I would be thinking that we would probably ask Nick and Scott to talk a little bit about implementation to provide a context for any subsequent discussion. Perhaps if they began by describing their project, we could then proceed to talk about a kind of pataphysics or any other theoretical mandate that might inform it. For those of who may not be familiar with the work, so at least we have some specific context within which we can gauge our discussion.
Well, the project of implementation, this collaboration between Scott and myself, takes place initially on these sheets of label paper, these sheets of stickers, in which 240 short texts are printed. And there are 8 different installments that we sent out over the course of the past year, 3 sheets in each installment, which tell the story of a town called Implementation, in which there are 4 main characters who live rather ordinary American lives in different ways, and whose lives intersect, and who experience the early phases of the American War on Terror. And I can say some things about the form of the project and the situation of the project in relation to other particularly literary or artistic efforts, or also some things about what the project is about in terms of its themes. One thing to mention is that in writing this, we had hoped to create something that was a novel. And some things that we thought about were, Mark Soportis' composition number 1, which is 100 loose sheets of paper that can be shuffled and read in any order. But actually, Our constraint was even more severe than this because we thought that someone who only saw one of our stickers placed somewhere in a public surface in some city in the world, that that would be a valid experience of the novel as well. And we wanted to have something that would be meaningful even in that small fragment. And in many ways, we were interested also in writing at the boundary between history and current events, looking at the war in Afghanistan at a time when it had been eclipsed by the war in Iraq, but looking at something that was not too far away to consider as what was going on in the news and the daily papers, but was not far enough away to really reflect on as if it were history. Maybe I'll let Scott talk some about how this relates to other forms of other artistic projects and situationist and guerrilla types of sticker art and other movements.
One thing that's interesting about the project is that from the get-go we thought there are at least three different types of readers. In that we were thinking, okay, we're going to send these installments of 30 stickers to a list of 10 to 20 people. I think we sent the first installment to Johanna. But then our constraint with that was they need to send us back photographs. In order to get the next installment. So there's that reader where you get these sheets of 30 stickers that are, we consciously thought, okay, each of these installments, you should be able to read any sticker in any order, but then the installments themselves are chronological. So the 30 stickers in any given installment should basically stand alone, but the events that occur in installment number two occurred in the novel after installment number one. So that's one type of reader, the reader who gets the stickers and reads them. Or if you go to the website, you can download these PDF installments. The second type of reader would be the person who just encounters them on the street. And, you know, who knows how many people have encountered these and thought, you know, what's this weird moment of narrative, and maybe, you know, figured that it might be part of a larger story, or maybe just thought this is odd that someone wrote a paragraph long story and stuck it on the parking ticket on my car, or, you know, on this sculpture at the, you know, Art Institute, or on this abandoned Soviet sports structure in Tallinn, Estonia. So that's the second type of reader. And then the third type of reader is the person who reads or experiences visually the archive of photographs on the website, which are sorted by date and by location. And then another interesting thing about this project is that we can then sort of remix these things from there. So we can select certain parts of the novel and put them together as a short story that can be read linearly. We might do a coffee table book at some point with, you know, all or some of the stickers. Or we might, you know, just release the photographs into the, you know, public domain and see what other people do with them. So that part of the project is also kind of exciting to me in that it's sort of multimedia in the sense of appearing in multiple media, not just being, you know, a picture on the web, but that it has multiple manifestations. And then what else was I supposed to talk about?
Situationism.
Oh, okay. Well, situationism, I mean, essentially, and the interactivity. You know, Nick and I have both done electronic writing projects, and we always talk about interactivity in some, you know, form. You know, you click on a link is, you know, a basic form of interactivity. Or in a work of interactive fiction, you might type into a parser, like, the genre that came out of adventure Nick's written about extensively. This is a different type of interactivity in that, you know, people get something physical and then they sort of play dramaturge in that they read, ideally, they might just stick them up at random anywhere they go, right? But ideally, I was thinking of people reading the stickers and saying, what would be an interesting place for someone else to read this? And how would I change this chunk of story by virtue of putting it on this public place or this object? Which probably didn't answer the question.
I mean, do you see this as a sort of graffiti that people will just like?
Well, I mean, a way that this works into the content of the project is that I see the war on terror, which this is largely about, as a form of graffiti. It's something that's sort of oppressively around us all the time. If we drive to Washington, D.C. on the highway out to Virginia, we see, the latest, what is it? Orange, yellow? What do we have? Yellow?
We're yellow.
Okay, so the yellow alert, constantly around us in a multitude of ways, right? So I see that as a form of graffiti, and in a way, this is, these stickers are in some ways a way of combating that kind of graffiti. And it's also kind of, when I saw the title of this event, sort of a post-textual avant-garde, I thought, well, wait a minute, this isn't necessarily, post-textual in the sense of after the text, right? In other words, posting text. And it's also sort of a nice, it's sort of nice that we're sneaking a novel into an art gallery. So there's sort of a post-art textual guard.
Yeah, I think the post was indeed not really something we thought out when we imagined this. And we thought of post-it precisely because of the sticker aspect. But it's also a question that may be too big for now, but about this question of modernism and, the debated post that one may or may not add to modernism, since this is something you worked on, and whether this is a term that you use or not, modernism as such, in your practice when you theorize it. I mean, for Gertrude Stein, clearly, no matter what modernism means, he's often described as modernist, and Jarry can be taken again as a sort of proto-modernist. So the post is not, of course, something we assert like that, but it's a question.
Well, I mean, I think to bring this back to the relationship between this project and the pataphysical, we might think about the way in which the trajectory of interventionist activity in the symbolic is part of modernism that I think we all feel invested in. I mean, I think the forms of modernism that we have inherited as writers and as thinkers are in many ways obsolete in the present. And the method of modernism that has to do with reinventing a space within the symbolic discourse for anything other than what is given to us as official language or administrative language, I mean, that's really been the project of modernism since its beginning in relationship to the Enlightenment, which is how do we find a space for thought within the administered condition of culture? And I think that the project of Romantic poetics from which modernism springs was very much a response to, how do we preserve something? How do we find a place to think? And I think in the contemporary condition, it's, so much is closed down. I mean, we live in such a conservative moment, a paranoid conservative moment. I mean, paranoia is a form of imagination. It's like the sort of thing we hold on to try to imagine the world that we live in. But what do we do now? One thing I love about your project is that it seems to me to kind of say, okay, the only place for language is in public. The only place to intervene, really, for literature is some place that happens by accident. that we have to be tactical, you know, sort of media activists if we're going to, I mean, we love what we do. We love our writing. We love poetry. We love, you know, the people in this room love this, but the world doesn't. The world has no use for it, has no engagement with it. So what do we do to find a place in this world? And I think the thing that I loved about your project was, let's put it out. You know, let's take people by surprise. I mean, epistemological defamiliarization has always been one of the great tools of the modernist avant-garde. It's still our great tool. It's still the thing that we can use to kind of introduce some slippage. It's the banana peel of thought in the administered culture. You know, it's the thing we're trying to do. We're powerless, but we'd still like to watch the world slip up, you know, so that we could make it think again. And so, you know, and again, and I'd love to hear to hear Christian talk about this, and Steve too, the patacritical tradition and pataphysical, what we call it, the patacritical tradition, Virginia, I'm sorry, but the pataphysical, you know, legacy in terms of, you know, just sort of imagining other and the science of exceptions and, you know, how you create spaces for thinking that aren't already thought. So, you know, that we can, you know, have our lives to think again imaginatively. That's what literature's for. It's not really for careers and professionalism and publications and fame and money, though we all like that. I mean, it's, you know, something else drives us, which has to do with ways of thinking that seem addictive and aphrodisiac, actually.
Well, I mean, the first thing I note about this project is that it constitutes a kind of reevaluation of the role of the book as a unit of composition, which I think constitutes one of the defining features of a modern sensibility, is that you express, if you think, if there's a space for literature, it takes place under the rubric of a codex or a book that can be self-contained. And I think within the context of, you know, modern life is really now a thick calling card by which, you know, you exchange a certain cultural capital with each other.
Right.
But here you actually have a kind of a distributed, much more nebulous notion of literary engagement, which is far more atomistic. It's never complete for anybody who might be encountering it accidentally. They might get some self-contained fragment, but they're probably not going to get a fully coherent and cogent appreciation of the project as a whole. And in fact, for that reason, it might seem somewhat endless in its imagination, because of course you could always imagine that you've missed one of the stickers, or that there's some neglected component of the book that is out there somewhere, if only you had the wherewithal to find it. In that respect, it becomes now a kind of way of life that is imminent within the environment itself, that somehow the book could be everywhere, and you only get to see one small facet of it exposed, you know, at any one time. You could
incompleteness is a wonderful gesture against commodity.
Absolutely,
you know, closure. It really is.
I mean, I think that the fact that now you actually have an interactive and collective readership, which defines in many respects how we actually read and interact when we talk about literature. I mean, I know that, for example, if I'm reading a book, I will seize upon particular passages that I will be able to requote to somebody, but I'll have forgotten minor, or, you know, minor segments that are of no interest personally, whereas somebody else will have seized upon those areas that I've forgotten or that I've neglected and will requote them back to me. And it seems to me that in a certain sense here, you actually have a situation in which a community could be, you know, resuscitating or reinforcing their own collective readership, you know, mutually saying, oh, I saw, you know, this component of the novel, you know, on board an airplane washroom, or, you know, I saw that component of the novel, you know, in a Soviet stadium. And there's a way in which you then become collective contributors, I guess, to the experience of the readership, contributing some small fragment of your experience with the book, wherever it might have been. Now, in response to this kind of notion of terrorism, I think the most powerful contribution on the website is actually those that contributor who put her or his segment of the novel throughout an airline passenger plane. So it's affixed on the backs of seats or in the airline washroom or on the sides of the stewardess's carts. These, you know, moments seem, you know, really pregnant with much significance, you know, given the content of the work itself. It seems somehow really dramatic at that moment. And by virtue of the fact that most of us understand literary activity, at least the, you know, certainly younger people will understand literary activity increasingly as their, as an active interactive engagement with the internet, that which is by its very nature a distributed and ephemeral experience of writing and textuality. This seems, you know, a perfectly 21st century notion of literary activity, one that's highly communal and distributed and incomplete and in a certain sense not functioning within the idea of a book as a unit of composition.
Have you put little tags on those labels so you can see how geographically distributed they are? Sort of like the way that natural,
well,
yeah, like
well,
the way
this is my recommendation that they should have GPS microchips on all the labels, you know, so that people could actually locate it on some sort of treasure hunt.
Yeah.
You could go and see each of the component fragments of the text, no matter where they might be distributed. You'd actually have
Do you have any idea how geographically distributed they are?
I mean, it's always, it's interesting because to do that, you know, one of the things as soon as people get GPS cell phones or, you know, GPS receivers, they get on their bikes and make GPS drawings of riding around town in certain shapes and things like this. And so in a sense that, you know, that creates another dimension in which, you know, we suddenly want to see the novel distributed a certain way to have a certain pattern appear. And there were obviously reasons why technologically it was prohibitive to do that. But also, you know, one thing that wouldn't have been difficult would have been to put a URL on the stickers, indicating, you know, where you can go on the web to read the rest of this novel. And we didn't
Which
do that.
Which would have been like putting up a Nike sticker.
Yeah, I mean, the issue with that is that it then makes every sticker into an advertisement for the website.
Yeah, I don't think you should be doing
rather
that.
Rather than literary work. And that was something that we either didn't consider at all or considered very briefly and dismissed.
No, we considered it dismissed.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to have a kind of cartographic record of where this graffiti is located,
well,
and where it's appeared.
We have a cartographic record of who sent us back photographs.
Yeah.
And one of the things I like about the we talked about, well, should we be using better stickers that would, you know,
archival
that would
stickers.
Adhere. Yeah, archival stickers that would adhere for a long
Enjoy
time.
Enjoy the elements.
Your car is illegally parked sticker.
Yeah, it would not go away. And I sort of like the fact that the project is designed to be printed on cheap Avery, you know, business shipping labels. And that some of the most interesting moments for me with this project, and both in writing it and one of the great pleasures for me has been in, you know, participating in the project by putting these up and photographing them, and, you know, it's been one of the joys of my life for the last year. But going back to places that I've been before and seeing the stickers, you know, 4 months later, kind of half-rotted, if they weren't disturbed or half torn off, there's something about that sort of both the fact that it's ephemeral and that it lasted that, you know, that it lasted that long.
Uh-huh.
That you sort of have, and, you know, I don't know that we need a, you know, a cartographic record. You know, we know from certain people sending them back that it's gotten around a bit, and it's really, you know, it's cool when you get that sticker from Tokyo, and you know, to know that it's been out there. But I think it'd be a different type of project and an interesting type of project, but sort of track a meme. And there are, you know, there are interesting sort of sticker art projects going on right now, where they're often one image. You know, Andre the Giant is a is a popular one, or the Visual Narcotic sticker that you might have seen some of those, where that's sort of the point, is getting one image everywhere. And I was just, last weekend I was in Chicago, and, you know, I saw, there used to be, when I lived there in my old neighborhood in Worker Park, there were some occasional sticker art. Now every single municipal sign in the neighborhood is just paper, is completely stickered over. So I don't know, there are a variety of different types of sticker art projects going on. And there are interesting RFID, you know, and GPS art projects going on now as well. But I think for this particular project, we liked the idea that, you know, if you read one of these stickers and you're really intrigued, you know,
you're likely to run across one nearby.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then B, if you're really intrigued, you can write down the text and type it into Google. You know, if you type in a sentence from one of those stickers into Google, you're going to run across the project. So there's a sort of treasure hunt aspect of that. And in terms of, you know, our knowing of it, I think it's the same as any type of publishing project where you create an object or an artifact and then you let it out into the world. We get a little joy in that sometimes, you know, the world gives back and sends us photographs. But we don't need that every time. You know, I mean, you don't get that every time you publish a book. You
mm-hmm.
get a note from every single person who reads it.
But I mean, I do think it's fascinating that we have response from people. We get a glimpse of the readers and the worlds that they live in, affixing these stickers in various places. But there's an aspect of the project. You know, it's not an anonymous project. You go to the website, you see our names. You know, we have the project in our art gallery. We come and sit on a couch and say things. But at the same time, there's an aspect of the project that, like sticker art itself, is very anonymous. No one has any idea what this label stuck onto a wall is, where it came from. There's no curatorial text next to it explaining how one is supposed to contextualize or interpret it. And I think that's a sense, you know, in a sense we're asking people to engage with the world and to be their own curators and to appreciate art in different contexts. And we're providing something that is not associated with a name or with a literary or artistic tradition. Actually, I think this is something that's quite different from many threads of the avant-garde, in that, you know, we're looking to what people do in underground practices like sticker art and putting things in the world, slapping images onto public surfaces without, some people may know who sticker artists are, but they're even more obscure than other artists, which is not saying much, right?
To be a little bit kind of skeptical, I mean, there's a way that sticker art, I think about the early work of Jenny Holzer and the parking mm-hmm. meter projects in the late 70s, and it became a way to brand her, and then she moved into gallery life and so forth. So, you know, this way that the system offers the possibility of taking up the branding once it's established. So, you know, it'd be naive to imagine that there isn't a way that sticker art participates in a system of already established artistic practices. It does. I mean, I think that the interesting thing is to think about the way in which the historical trajectory of give and take has changed. I mean, there's a way that we take from popular culture and put back into popular culture in relationship to avant-garde practice. And, you know, think about Dada artists putting out their leaflets, you know, in Zurich and, you know, inviting the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker to come to their performances and then having all these people show up and say, oh my God, that's what you're doing, you know. So there's the porousness of those realms of, again, exchange. I think that, you know, that the sticker art circulates in a certain way within, you know, a kind of world at large, but it's visual form, to go back to, you know, this issue of the visual, you know, identity of those works. Mm-hmm. Those stickers are very distinctive. Mm-hmm. They have a look. They have a design. You can say they're, like, designed to be neutral, but, you know, mm-hmm. that design is distinctive. It's a particular label. They're all uniform. They have the same typeface. They all have a certain number of words. Certain words are capitalized. I mean, there's a style within them. So that anybody who's seen one immediately recognizes the next that they see. So, you know, that's not a criticism, but it's an acknowledgement that there is within the work itself an internal kind of set of identifiers that say this is part of a piece. This mm-hmm. is, mm-hmm. it's a distributed piece whose pieces, whose atoms are meant to all resonate.
Well, it also opens it up to counterfeit interventions, right? You know,
you could proceed to counterfeits. Yeah.
That's right. You could imagine somebody writing a branch of narratives off
yours
and adding, you know, a kind of unsolicited
subverting the
subverting
implementation
product.
Narrative.
Sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Somebody,
a conformist implementation narrative.
Somebody
in
England's blogging about doing a Brit stick lit novel where he would take. I think using the same format, but where he would take, like, you know, segments of Dickens and post them up around London.
Yeah.
The sun never sets.
But perhaps one could talk about the material aspect, since really you've chosen a certain format, and it has to be, it's in a way, it's not electronic, it's not handmade, but it's something that expands the space of the text into the city. And thinking back to, you know, the time of high modernism, whenever you look at old postcards of, say, Philadelphia or Paris in the 1910s, 1905, it's amazing how much writing you see on the walls everywhere. That has completely disappeared. When Apollinaire was writing about poetry is in advertising and newspapers, he really meant it. You could look at the walls, they were covered, of course, with publicity and names and so on. That has been whitewashed, as it were. And we've lost that materiality of writing, even if it was not really poetry, but some kind of vulgar popular culture that could be seen as objective Dadaism, as it were.
Yeah, the 1890s to the 1930s are really the great period of public language. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the role of the affiche in that period is incredible. I mean, you look at the, I mean, now we have the, you know, marquees and the moving languages at Times Square, but zoning laws came in with such a force in the 1920s to legislate what neighborhoods were going to be available for public language. That we don't have public language the way that we did at the turn of the century. It's just incredible how it takes over, you know, to the point where Benjamin in 1930 says, oh, a little child being born, you know, by the time they're 5 years old has been so inundated with the language of advertising, the stuff they see in the street, that they can't even learn to read. That's the 1930s. They say, you can't learn how to read because you've been so dosed with advertising language. You know, and now it comes to us through media, but not so much in the public realm, not as much as it used to. And I think that's one of the ways that I think going back into, you know, sort of like physical sticking on the space of the world is a nice aspect of this.
There's a lot of text. I mean, actually, you know, the media, the public media being the internet, I certainly think we're still inundated with
Or if you look at text, for sure. But I think your point is that maybe a lot of it's sort of proprietary.
Like, if you look at television now compared to television 15 years ago, and you think about the text on television.
I'm thinking about city walls. I'm thinking about the urban space of text. In 1890 to 1930, I mean 1880s, 1890s, there's just this, you know, incredible papering of the cityscape, because there are no laws yet to legislate. And then they come in the 19-teens, the 1920s, with a sense that, oh, this explosion of the capabilities of print and the bill stickers, you know, I mean, it's really the late 19th century. The bill sticker becomes a public figure who's going all over the place, wallpapering the public space with advertising. And huge. I mean, these are, you know, lithostones that are 10 feet tall that are being used for advertisement. We don't have that now. We have
real-world spam.
Right. But we don't our
physical spam.
With physical spam.
That's what I mean. You know, you could imagine, you know, language here being a kind of form of daily pollution that's covering every surface. I'm not so sure you'd be happy about that. You know, if every surface was, you know.
No, I'm not advocating that we go back to that. Yeah. But I'm saying that you know, we live in a different different condition of relationship to the physical presence of language in the landscape.
Right. Yeah.
Than we did, than people did in the 19-teens. We think that we're more inundated now than ever. But in fact, the you know, there have been different moments in terms of the way in which the capabilities of the technological production of print in the public perception and the public landscape, and the urban landscape in particular, were different than they are now. I mean, we actually are in there's actually a diminishment of presence in some ways of language in the public landscape.
But here, I think their project is designed to, I think, to be in response to the themes of world terrorism, somewhat more subversive and stealthly, you know, kind of activity. You know, it's supposed to be something you do very secretively, and you discover it almost by accident because it's so small, and it's supposed to have a you know, the character of a secret, you know, that, that we all share collectively, knowing, you know, that you can discover this little clue to a literary activity that would otherwise be ignored. And it says that something, I think, about the actual status of literature as a practice, you know, within contemporary culture, that is increasingly
is
a stealth practice, or, you know, a kind of stealth culture that takes place under the radar of common, you know, mass media. Here, you know, you actually have then a, you know, subsequent contribution where you've got like ornithologists going, "I've had a sighting," and you can photograph the little bird, and you post it, you know, on, online as a little, you know, an Elvis sighting, if you like, of a certain literary practice that would otherwise go unnoticed. And it takes on, I think, the character of, you know, that kind of panoptic character of, you know, of terrorist interventions. I mean, you have the great anecdote about trying to affix a sticker and take a picture of your own and being found out by the police. You probably would.
Well, yeah.
Where was that?
30th Street Station. Well, I saw a sticker that I'd photographed, that I'd posted about a month earlier. It was kind of half torn off and, you know, looked interesting, so I photographed it. And then I walked outside to meet Nick, and I was surrounded by, you know, four guys with machine guns and black, you know, shirts who, you know, interrogated me about, not about, and I'd actually put up a couple of stickers too, but not about not about putting up stickers. They hadn't even noticed that. What they'd noticed was that I was photographing a trash can in 30th Street Station, and it turned out, you know, they asked me why I was doing that, and I said, well, I take photographs of details of cities, not wanting to admit, you know, my vandalism. And they said, well, that's sort of an odd detail of a city to be taking a photograph of. And I'm like, what? And they said, a bomb-proof trash can. And they hadn't noticed any of the stickers. what they wanted to interrogate me about was why I was photographing bomb-proof trash cans when I didn't even realize that the trash can itself was bomb-proof.
Yeah, that's scary. But, you know, I mean, that brings up another issue, which is the sense of, like, where is free space to post things? And I don't know if you follow the work of the Critical Art Ensemble and their work in tactical media, but, you know, a lot of their work is designed to demonstrate that our assumption of free speech is actually very much an assumption, and that as soon as you start to actually take that assumption and act on it, it turns out not to be true that almost every space that we occupy, well, you're Canadian, but every space that we that we occupy is, in fact, police. It's a police space. I mean, every space has some surveillance operation, and that's exactly what you're saying, is that, you know, that even recording your own vision comes under surveillance of some authority, and you think that you have the right to look. That's all you were doing, was enacting your right to look and record that looking, and that turns out to be an act that comes under surveillance, and then perhaps more than surveillance, discipline and authority, and that you're suddenly subject to authority just for looking and recording your looking, let alone speaking and expressing your speaking. Mm-hmm. So that actually is the condition in which we live, and that is not okay.
Yeah, and here it's a specific kind of looking, though, as he's actually reading something. You know,
he's
actually affixed, he's affixed a little label to a trash can, right, and photographing that. I mean, it's, you know, it's not just about looking at something, but
looking,
you know,
and
thinking about it, you know, reading at it, you know, reading.
Public thinking is
public thinking very bad.
I don't think public thinking is protected in the any of the First Amendment rights.
I mean, one of the ideas of posting stickers in public places, taking photographs of them, is that you're invited to not only read the sticker, but also read the space, read the location. And if it's a bomb-proof trash can that you're reading, you know, that can get you in trouble, but you also may be reading, you know, people playing soccer in Paris, or, you know, people on the Baltic Sea on a cruise, or, you know, various other things, and looking at this with a different eye than you would if it were a snapshot that someone was trying to foist on you because it was a vacation photo or something like that.
Mm-hmm. How many sets of stickers did you send out to start?
So there were 8 installments of 3 sheets each.
But how many did you send out in the first installment? How many
about
people?
15, maybe in the first installment.
Yeah, and then the cast of stickeries changed.
Uh-huh. I know some of us didn't play.
And then, the other thing is that
I was scared to put those stickers
up. We're posting them, and we still have posted the PDFs on the web with instructions on how to print them on standard shipping labels. So it wasn't just the people we sent them to; it was also people who just downloaded the PDFs
and printed
them.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah. So.
And how many photographs have you gotten back of posted?
1,100.
Oh,
close to 1,200.
Maybe to return to the question of the future or of this or what to do next or the avant-garde element, and I was thinking of since we have in the vault this project by Arakawa and Gins, who are artists who think of themselves as being a sort of, in their case, post-textual avant-garde, who have, in a way, left behind the practice of writing to build different buildings and so on, give a different utopia, maybe, on the city. And it was also thinking back to the 60s, the way the Situationist city has, I think, failed, but also came out of a textual avant-garde with letterism that became a certain kind of situationism, and with the practice of urban drifting, with text and so on, but then a number of their friends would just get lost, and it had to become a political movement. How do you situate yourself facing these two ways of radicalizing the textual moment? Do you see yourself as part of a certain avant-garde there, or doing something that gives pleasure but will be replaced by another kind of activity later on?
Well, one thing, and I know a lot of writers who have worked in electronic media who have made moves to become internet artists or reconceive themselves as internet artists after being writers, and that's something that I'm more interested in, the idea of how do we utilize new media of various kinds, or old media, to sort of reconfigure literature in a way that makes it relevant to contemporary audiences who might otherwise not be interested in literature. So in some ways, I don't know if that's avant-garde or rear-garde, to think, how do we recreate literary experiences utilizing available means and available audiences. So even in my work in electronic writing, I'm thinking as much about, and I'm particularly interested in, novels on the network, which is a weird form for the network, right? But how do you take these two disparate media, or how do you take stickers and novels, and create something new that, the generation, whatever the invisible generation, I know everybody's reading Harry Potter and everything, but, that's more inclined to play Halo or to...
I mean,
put up a sticker for their favorite band.
That's the major competition now, right? I mean, Halo 2 made more money in one weekend than any other aesthetic object in human history. You're going to write a book that competes with that kind of experience.
Well, right.
It would be very challenging to imagine.
Competing is different. I mean, literature has been, the 20th century didn't belong to literature as the dominant medium.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we create experiences that speak, in some way to the same impulses that make people want to play Halo or make people want to put up an Andre the Giant sticker?
Well, I think the understanding would be then to redefine those experiences as literary, and say that that's the context under which books, are reconceived, that you no longer pick up a codex necessarily, but you have to actually do integrate, interact with a kind of a stickered experience.
Codex,
yeah. But I think for many of us, that's the object of study. I think the notion of a post-textual is a little bit misleading because it would suggest that there's, a kind of post-readerly activity taking place. But I'm not so sure about that.
I agree. Yeah. I don't think we're post-textual in the least. I think we're post-avant-garde, but I don't think we're post-textual. I mean, I would reverse those. Because I think we're deeply textual in all kinds of ways, and especially if you take text to mean any kind of capacity to be literate in relationship to symbolic discourse. We are increasingly textual in that sense. So, I think the question of what is the place for aesthetics and for literary activity and the traditions that we come out of, I think that's a different kind of question than the question of what's the status of the symbolic within the current contemporary experience.
I just want to, relating to Halo 2, I think I'm certainly not interested at all in outselling Halo 2, but rather perhaps in giving away more literature than Linux is given away.
Right.
I think the idea of trying to set up some commercial competition with what literature can do isn't at all on the right track. And one of the things that's interesting to me about implementation is that it places the gift economy of the internet and the web in the physical space where people actually, can walk up and read a physical sticker that someone's placed there.
Right.
We send stuff in the mail to people. They can download it and print it out themselves if they like. It's free. And that's...
I'm thinking when the topic of interactive fiction comes up, immediately, it's the video game milieu. It's the model, against which your success is evaluated.
Even the online game.
Anything.
Even more than the the video game.
Interactive experience online.
Huge communities.
For that area of expertise is regarded as non-literary, when in fact, of course, there are many literary interventions into that space. Among my favorite ones are people who've gone to the Quake online competitions and have refused to actually go around killing people, but have proceeded then to enact a Friends episode, reciting all the lines from Friends on the instant messaging service that allows players to communicate with each other. They start posting lines from Friends. So this becomes a distributed activity that's taking place within the same venue as that game. And I know that on one online First World War military game, whose name escapes me now, I think it's Badge of Honor probably, somebody came online and refused to actually participate, just stood there and proceeded to recite Siegfried Sassoon poems on the instant messaging service. And the irony there is that promptly the subsequent players, annoyed by this intervention in their space, proceed to abandon whatever missions they're on to go and hunt down and kill this person who's participating in the online experience.
Right? Get rid of those poets.
To get rid of the poet, right? Who's obviously disrupting
them. So in the way.
Now, you can see a way in which the appropriation of that experience seems to be an extremely performative literary experience. That truly
That's
is an interactive fiction, right? This has something, I suppose, to do with the idea of the pataphysical, an anomalous experience that would otherwise go ignored or be unappreciated is suddenly emphasized kind of forthrightly enacted within the space of this milieu. And it seems to me that a project like Implementation functions in a certain sense within that domain. It's appropriating the character of kind of sticker advertising and turning it into a literary experience. In the same way that, say, the makers of Red and Blue little movies, appropriate the movie sets of Halo and turn them into their own private movie studio and concoct these extremely satirical online videos that are very funny and critique the experience of playing those games.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. I think the function of literature is to be the anomaly that isn't completely ignored. Mm-hmm. It's the anomaly that registers as an anomaly against the norm. And if you can do that, then that is the success of both the traditions that we believe in and the contemporary experience that we want to keep opening up.
Mm-hmm. On a practical level, one of the things that I hope Implementation does, and which I see other things doing, one of these things is to help us to be able to read on a very small scale very deeply. And this is actually different. You might conceive of analogous things going on with performance online and multiplayer spaces and so forth. But here I just talk literally about text.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense that we know how to surf the web, but do we know how to stop and read a particular paragraph with very deep understanding of it? And those I think are the skills that people have to acquire. I don't mean in some type of a crass vocational sense, but I mean in order to be readers, critical thinkers, in order to politically be sensible and be able to take action, you know, related to their government, to their life, in order to have personal and literary experiences, that we need to realize that it's not just clicking through web pages to order something from Amazon.com or bid on something on eBay, or on the other hand, you know, sitting down with a codex for some number of hours and reading this in depth, but that there are things in between this experience. And that's what implementation, I think, is about. And even if these aren't textual experiences that you mentioned, I think these sorts of provocations that people enact online are similarly telling us, you know, read differently, understand the experience that you're having online differently. And you know, and it could just be like I wouldn't like it very much probably if there were someone taking pataphysical action on my basketball team as I were trying to play basketball.
No, you'd be annoyed.
But but on the other hand, you know, there are reasons
useful.
I'd be annoyed. Well, kick them off the team.
Thinking back to the I forget what we had it. What was it? Untitled series for bathroom stall wall. I think was. The first sticker project that we did was actually inspired by, you know, if you go to a tavern, almost any tavern now, and you go step up to a urinal in the men's bathroom, and I assume they're also in the women's bathroom, there's
we face the other way at some
point.
Yeah, but there's almost always advertising. And that's sort of the first inspiration for, we actually, the first, before we wrote implementation, we wrote a series of stickers that were intended to be placed in the bathroom because it was that sort of captive, you know, medium, right, where you're going to read this text by virtue of having, you know, virtually nothing else to look at.
Installed surreptitiously at the ICA, actually, here in Philadelphia.
No, but your point, Christian, is a good one. I mean, who wants a pataphysical dentist?
Yeah, I mean,
there are only certain areas of our life in which we really actually want these disruptive anomalies. No, it's an important point because, you know, there are areas where we actually like instrumental reason and we sort of still subscribe to it, right?
But I think there's something like when you have advertising in the physical spaces around you, a literary sticker to counteract this is appropriate.
Yeah.
Similarly, if you had, you know, people shouting advertising as you were playing basketball.
Yeah.
It might be a relief.
Again, it's in the symbolic sphere that we want these interventions. It's not really necessarily.
And we don't necessarily all want them, but we don't necessarily all want, you know, anything. You know, the art or the advertising or any, you know, anything that confronts us in the world. So I don't like sometimes I feel bad about sticker placements.
I wouldn't worry too much. We have Gooby gone. I want to hear you talk about the writing process itself. I mean, not the sticker part, but how did you write the project, and what was the interactive aspect there?
This project we actually wrote almost exclusively together. So we
almost exclusively together. Now, could we? Does that mean you were not ever in the same room? But
no, we almost never wrote them individually without being in the same place. So what we would do is we would at the start when the project was alone, we would go to an establishment with 3x5. I think you were there.
Yeah, but I want to hear it described.
So we had
publicly, confessionally.
3x5 note cards, which the handwriting roughly translates into a printed shipping label. And we would, first we wrote some cards with some general ideas about the project, which didn't, you know, necessarily convert into what it actually became. But we'd, you know, write cards and then pass them back to each other, and then we would take a fresh card and we would rewrite the card that the other one had just written.
So was the whole text composed before you did the stickers, or did you keep composing sheet after sheet?
No, I mean, we did that. That was the first 6 months or so. So we had the first most, I don't know, not 100, but 80 texts or so before we ever started putting them into sticker sheets. So we would do that. So we rewrote. So almost none of the stickers were written by one of the two of us. They were both written by both of us. And then we would, the real editing step occurred when we developed the template and put them into the template and realized, of course, that 3x5, you can fit a lot of text on a 3x5 note card. And then we had to, you know, murder our darlings. And so we would then rewrite the text and then edit it and then edit it again and then proofread it. And then we only caught, like, you know, 4 printed typos in the whole thing. But, yeah, so we just kept rewriting each other's stuff until it became nobody's writing.
I guess we'll all have stickers to distribute to everybody in the audience. And I think maybe we could just, since we said it wouldn't be much longer than 1 hour, ask whether anybody has a question. Yes.
My first question is for Christian. I'm going to provide a bit of background, so I hope you bear with me.
Sure.
One of the facets of your remarkable accomplishment, you know, that is one of the first to be brought up whenever anyone attempts to describe the project, is the astonishing fact that it is not computer assisted. It would have been possible for a third grade programmer probably to write a pack together a script that would have compiled the vocabulary that you, according to these descriptions, got yourself by reading dictionaries over the course of what I imagine were months or years. This fact brings with it the implication, A, that you are the man who defeats machines, sort of Superman who's faster than the speeding locomotive, and also the slightly more varied subtext that you're either a Luddite or would sort of eschew the use of computers to write a text like that. And I just wanted to get your take on that.
Oh, well, if I could have written it with a machine, I would happily do it. I mean, quite frankly, I would love to have the entire writing practice delegated to a machine and just reap the royalty benefits. Honestly, if I had a golden goose that could just you know, shoot out texts after I go up to it and say, I have this great idea for a book, and can you finish it for me, I would be most relieved as a writer. I'm certainly very interested in computer-assisted writing, in part because I regard that as an aspect of the whole prosthetic experience of writing, you know, which is a delegation of a certain kind of mental authority to language itself. I don't see that there'd be any problem with the use of those machines, and certainly use of the internet by Nick and Scott here as a way of generating artistic and textual experience without effort, right? You've delegated now some of that effort, right, to those people in the world who are willing to download the work and photograph it and return it to your website. I mean, it seems to me you've got now, you know, this small army of aesthetes out there in the world who are prepared to do your web design on your own, you know, for you, to produce surprises for you. If I had the expertise to have programmed a Perl script at the time, I would have. But it occurred to me that it would take just as long for me to actually learn the software or to dragoon somebody into doing it for me as simply reading the dictionary 5 times. I figured that I might as well just make the effort. I would gain some street credibility for having made this athletic commitment to the labor, so I did it, and I just wanted to get started. I didn't want to have to wait to learn a new set of skills, a new catechism, in order to embark upon the project. So no, I'm neither a Luddite. In fact, I am fully, I think, you know, in many respects, a futurist at heart. And if I really had the opportunity, if I had those skills at hand, I would have certainly made use of them. I don't see much value in not making use of those resources if I have access to them. Yeah.
I actually see Christian in a parallel situation with Dr. Johnson, a 20th century parallel to Johnson in so many
ways. Right. Yeah, that if you could have written the dictionary with a computer, you would have.
Or more than 3 assistants.
That's right.
I have a point, actually, John, which actually links to pataphysics, which is matters of science or whatever. And it comes back actually to an issue of the anomaly and a more sinister dimension in which we can take pataphysics, which actually we swore a couple of weeks ago. I presented a thing called the Pataphysics of Amphics. And it's actually the whole notion of the law that governs the anomaly, the law that governs the sign state, that addresses not the, the general, but the exception, that one can trace back actually to mid-19th century Prussian law that allowed in states of exception, and this was political exception, which was a certain unruly, to suspend law, basically. What happens from there, and again, let's trace that, is one gets the manifestation of the camp. It does not start with the Nazis, but it was actually created either by the Spanish influence in Cuba or the British in the World War. But it's based exactly on that same pataphysical principle of how does one govern the rule of the exception. And what one gets is a rule that allows the suspension of
That's so interesting, yeah.
Well, within the context of the terrorism as a topic of this this particular work.
I know. It is. It's a precise example.
Right.
Well, because you have to have a space that can be suspended completely from law by defining it as outside. I mean, it's true. Well, I mean, I don't know what you think about the relationship between the history of pataphysics and the history of statistics, but certainly the notion of the anomaly in statistics is so interesting in relationship to the history of pataphysics and the way in which outliers are defined and yet usefully, I mean, they're both excluded and definitive within any statistical system. So, you know, it seems so, you know, Foucauldian. It's, you know, like that which disciplines is also that which excludes. And it defines itself by exclusion exactly at that point where it can find an anomaly such that the law applies within the boundary that's defined where the anomaly isn't. And I think that is what we see. It's interesting to me, I think, to sort of outside of what we've been talking about, but to see the way in which systems theory has kind of emerged as a way to think about these things in relationship to larger cultural patterns that aren't only describable in the kind of older humanistic patterns that we thought about, but match up with the things that we intuitively knew from these aesthetic observations or cultural theoretical perceptions. So but I think I agree with you.
Question. Can you speak up?
You have to speak a little more forcefully. I usually respond to questions about the role of my authorship in the book by suggesting that, in many respects, it's the only book that could have been written, no matter who wrote it, according to those sets of fixed constraints. But I think that if anybody attempted to do the same exercise, they would probably come up with a very similar kind of writing. I mean, it would be very interesting to see somebody come up with something radically different using those same set of fixed constraints. I prefer to think that somehow, in the course of working on this book, it was an act of subordinating my own a desire to write something on my own and allowing the vowels to conspire amongst themselves to speak on their own behalf. It's not as though I've imposed a narrative upon these particular sets of rules. You know, I've come with a story prefabricated and I try to make it fit in a kind of Procrustean way, this set of fixed constraints. The entire narrative is derived almost entirely from the possibilities and potentials that are imminent within the language itself. In that sense, I think it's a relatively egoless activity. Much like this work, while you dismiss it as not anonymous, is nevertheless a relatively egoless dissemination of the literary enterprise, right? All of a sudden, it's possible to imagine writing a work which is collectively read in such a way that those readers actually contribute to the subsequent understanding or readership of the book. There's a kind of collective contribution at play there, to which your own will is somehow subordinated. In some respects, I think that Inouye is not a dramatization of any lyrical or expressive sentiment on my own part. If anything, if it reveals anything about me as a personality, it's my obsessive compulsive disorders and my bloody mindedness. At best, a certain kind of passion and intensity.
Obsessive compulsive advantage.
Advantage. Okay, that's right. It reveals something about that aspect of my attitude, but I don't think it reveals much about me as a writer. Otherwise, I think that if a program were subjected to the same set of algorithmic constraints, I imagine they would come up with something very, very similar. It would be only marginally different. I don't think that, it would be very interesting to imagine or ask somebody to go through the same grueling process. I doubt anybody would, but I would be curious to see if somebody actually were able to upstage that practice while producing something that was radically different, told a completely different story. It would be very interesting if somebody were capable of doing that.
Yeah, not very many. We'd like more, but yeah.
So, what you're asking is whether the labels that we use to
the same labels at the same time.
The only time we used Futura a particular size was for the text of the novel itself. We didn't use it for the return address labels or the labels for people because in fact it wasn't part of that.
Because we novel. It was quicker.
and but yeah, we did. There were some stickers affixed to various living creatures.
Yeah, there's still a set. Somebody has promised me a set from Australia that is completely.
Did we get any on Shelley actually?
On Shelley Jackson?
Yeah.
Not yet.
No.
Okay. I wasn't going to trade her the tattoo space.
Yeah.
That's a very good idea.
Her project, you might have heard about it, is a story, a short story called Skin. But where she put out a call for participants to each become a word. And so for each word, and I asked her actually, I was like, well, is that each word that's used or each instance of the word? And it's actually each instance of the word. So she's gotten close to 2,000 people who volunteered and who've had the word tattooed on their skin. And the only people who get to read the whole story are those who've actually had the word tattooed on their skin. So it's there's some relationship.
Unlike your project, though, she actually doesn't record in a common space like the web photos. I mean, actually, I think she probably should include photos of each of the individuals, not necessarily the word that's been attached to them, but it would be good to
see. I believe the plan, and I don't know if it's going to be on the web or just in a gallery, but she's asking them to send back a photo of the word, which is often on people's arms or wherever they decide to put it. And they don't choose the word, by the way. It's just assigned to them. That's why.
Yeah.
but also a picture of themselves. So that I think when she does assemble stuff together, it'll just be a wall of faces.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the contractual agreement that she's the other aspect of the contract is that she's promised to go to to make as many of the funerals of her words while she's living as possible. I mean, actually, in some ways, this project's been going on longer than implementation. I think she had originally, it was a conceptual art piece that she published in a magazine thinking that no one would ever actually do this. And it's sort of become crippling to her, and the extent of mail that she literally got RSI from typing responses, and it's become a real burden, and she feels very obligated to these people, obviously, because they volunteered their flesh for her, literature. So that's a post-textual avant-garde.
Yes?
I have a question for Scott and Nick. With Scott's intriguing statement that the war on terror is graffiti, you addressed a little bit the relationship between the content that is the word choice of implementation and the social context in which it was written and distributed. I wondered if I could nudge you a little further to talk more about the relationship between the form, that is the unconventional distribution method, wonderfully so, by the way, and the content, be it thematic issues, more tedious workmanlike fiction writing issues like point of view or character, and most vexingly, the idea of sequence to which most traditional fiction is bound.
Okay.
So let me mention one aspect of this. I mean, one thing that is, I think, important about the novel and the project overall is that it's an American novel. It's written from the perspective that Scott and I have as Americans. And one thing to do about this would be to pretend that we're not Americans and try to write something universal and not situated in culture, which doesn't seem like a very intelligent or fruitful thing to do. Or another thing to do would be to reflect on this in a certain way and critique American culture from the standpoint of it. But the fact that we have this novel, this text that's rooted in our own culture, and that we're asking people in other parts of the world to stick it on their public surfaces as well, is an aspect of the project. It's an anti-imperialist novel in certain ways, and yet the project itself is imperialist because we're asking people to take our American text and place it various places throughout the world. And that's a contradiction that I think we always have to deal with if we try to critique our society in a global context. So rather than flee that, we've tried to embrace it by situating the project that way.
And we welcome translations. I'm still waiting for the, the French.
Yeah.
Should be the first, I think. really? No, if anyone is bored. And then in terms of like fiction considerations, an interesting thing about this project, having written hypertext and when you're talking about, closure and the lack of closure, in some ways, from my perspective, this has more closure than The Unknown, which is a hypertext novel, in that there is a potential to read all of the stickers. It's not too, you can't... In an individual viewing on the street experience, you don't know what the whole thing is. But you can go on the web and you can read the whole damn thing, which is sort of refreshing, sort of less avant-garde for me as a writer. But then we did think of, we centered it on four characters and built them up in sort of traditional character kind of ways. One is an army reservist who works for PSYOPs. In the military, and his, first works in at base, and then is shipped off to Iraq. Another character is a cardboard box manufacturer, who eventually gets contracts from the Pentagon. Another character is a Kinko's employee, and another character is a database and programmer. Person. So each of whom, so we're trying to look at different ways that terror affects the lives of these, or the war, not terror really, but the war on terror, affects the lives of these people in a peripheral sense. Because I think, the most, certainly many people are, suffering in ways that I have no conception of right now. And
in Iraq and, you know, all over the place from the war on terror. But the way that I can write about it most effectively is the way that we've experienced it, which is as a peripheral phenomenon that sort of, you know, has been encroaching on our lives progressively for the last, you know, 3 years. So that's the war is, I mean, the novel is really about how, you know, the war on terror became this sort of perpetual war in dread. And then in terms of, you know, there is this sort of a gesture type of activity in which, you know, putting something up, putting up stickers about a library bombing on the New York Public Library is a gesture about the war on terror, but it's, you know, it's just, it's a gesture.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we hope to accomplish is, you know, a different perspective on the United States and a different perspective on the war on terror. And one of the ways that one might accomplish this is by reading the entire narrative of the novel. But also, one might accomplish this by seeing a single sticker with its anecdote or dialogue or other situation. And that might have more of a provocative than a fully novelistic effect, but it might cause one to think a little bit differently about what otherwise would only be glimpsed in the newspaper and forgotten. So the purposes of the novel overall, I think, were consistent with this fragmentation that that was contained within its possibilities.
Well, thank you very much. You're welcome for wine and drinks and discussions afterwards, but thanks again for...
Thank you for your patience. We really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you all for coming.